We come to our guest for the evening, and Graham did just comment that it's not too often he finds himself on the left of me, but that's where he is at the moment. Now, we're sitting up, if for anyone who needs some orientation, we're sitting up where the main table was during the day. So
which is right here.
I'm off mic now. Yeah. Okay? Yep. Alrighty. So, firstly, thank you to Graham for agreeing to come and chat with us tonight. I just need to give Graham a bit of introduction, and I am suffering from the partially sighted curses. I need to read what I'm saying, so bear with me for a moment. So, Graham Innes AM, although we may know him better for his PM, is a lawyer, mediator, and company director. He has been a human rights practitioner for more than 30 years. Graham was a commissioner at the Australian Human Rights Commission for almost 9 years, responsible for issues relating to disability, race and human rights. In this role, he led work on the ratification by Australia of the UN Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities, the Same Sex, Same Entitlements Inquiry. Well, you stuff that one up.
I'll respond to that later on.
No, that's okay. Okay, same areas. Regulation in the areas of accessible building and transport, work with industry on TV and movie captions and accessible banking standards, and three inspections of the Australian Immigration Detention Centres. Graham led the merger of four blindness agencies to form Vision Australia and chaired the board of that agency. He is currently the chair of Attitude Australia Foundation, a start-up aimed at using media to change attitudes towards Australians with disabilities. He's also board member of Life Without Barriers, a $300 million turnover NFP, providing support to people with disabilities, Aboriginal people, asylum seekers and children in out-of-home care. And Livable Housing Australia, an initiative of the disability sector and the property industry to ensure that new houses in Australia are designed and built to meet the needs of all Australians. Graham was awarded an AM for his work on the development of the Disability Discrimination Act and was a finalist for Australian of the Year. He was awarded an honorary doctorate by the University of Canberra in recognition of his work as a human rights activist. Graham is married with two children, loves cricket. I might change that after today. As a spectator, sailing as a participant, and relaxes by enjoying fine Australian wine. And of course, we know him as a long-term active member of, and former board member of Blind Citizens Australia. So it's my pleasure to introduce Graham Innes. I suppose this evening's invitation was motivated by the fact that Graham has recently put out his autobiography, 50 Shades of Graham. A litany of sex, drugs and rock and roll. I am sorry, that was for the Family First Conference in a week or two, so ditch that one. Sorry about that. That was very unprofessional of me, mate. The book's actually called Finding a Way. So, Graham, I do have a few questions for you. And the first one is the one I asked Steve Patterson earlier in the evening. Why?
I thought Michael might hit me with a one-word question. You know, why did I write a book? Well, I guess I wanted to share some of the things that had happened in my life. I've always believed that in finding a way and in, you know, working out solutions and achieving what I sought to achieve, and in the company of many others, many of whom are in this room. So, and it's something that I suppose started very young with my father and my family, so I've enjoyed doing a lot of those things, and I just thought there were some things in there that I'd like to share. The importance that I place on peer support and on people with disabilities, particularly people who are blind or vision impaired, in you know, getting together and working with each other and learning from each other. And I've done so much of that during my life, and again from many people who are in this room, that I wanted to share some of the things that I'd learned. I've also had some funny things happen during my life, some of which are in the book, and I wanted to share those because I think that often a powerful message can be very effectively leavened by a bit of humour. I agreed with what Colleen said this morning in our convention. And the other reason, the last reason, I suppose, Michael, was that Maureen, my wife, had been saying to me for about 5 years, you know, you should write your story. And I'd always say to her, I know, I'm a doer and not a writer. I can write, but I write for other purposes, and I'm not really that interested in writing that story. And when I left the Human Rights Commission, I had two different publishers who came and approached me and asked me if I would write my story. And so I thought, oh, maybe Maureen's right after all, you know. So she was a bit pleased about that. So there's been a number of occasions when, in fact, most occasions when sometimes I just accept her view immediately, and other times it takes me a bit longer to catch up. But so I decided to sit down and put the words on the paper.
So the next question, and I just want to backtrack for a minute, and I do apologise for the earlier gaffe about 50 Shades of Graham. However, it is true that this book does contain a bit of what I said earlier. There's certainly some romance. There is mention of a bong at one stage.
There is.
And
I don't actually think the word bong... Yes, it did.
And thirdly, there was a band that did the local Sunday night gig at the local golf club, so that would have been a pretty wild group, I reckon.
So,
the next bit is, I've never doubted... I think it's about 90,000 words worth that was published, isn't it?
About that, yes.
Now, I've never doubted you for 1 minute you could speak that many words. How did you write that many words?
Well, it's interesting. That's an interesting question, because... one of the things that I said to Maureen when I was talking about writing the book was, the publisher said to me they wanted about 90,000 words. In the end, I wrote about 130,000. But I couldn't work out how to write that many words. I've never written anything like that length. And Maureen said to me, oh, that's about 50 speeches, and you've written hundreds of those in your life, so just write it as speeches. And that's actually what I did. So I wrote it in around 2,000-word chunks. And then I sort of put it together, and that was the way that was the formula that worked for me. I did get stuck at one time during the writing, so I was about two-thirds through the book, and I got stuck, and a lot of writers do get stuck, and I just couldn't sort of work out how to...
Is that where they put the pictures in?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, are there pictures in there, are there?
My
very wise 19-year-old solved the problem, because knowing my love of iPhone, she just said, oh, that's all right, Dad, that's easy. I'll just take your iPhone each morning and I won't give it back to you till you've written a chapter. And that was all the motivation I needed, so it worked a treat.
Graham, like many of us, I think you're very fortunate in that you had a very supportive and encouraging family and upbringing.
Mm, that's true.
You talk in the book about your schooling. And you spent up to year 10 at Northrop School.
That's right.
And then just went out into the mainstream school system for year 11 and 12.
Yep.
In retrospect, do you have any views on whether that was a wise way to go?
Oh, well, I've said in the book that if I'd had my time over again, I would have gone to a mainstream school. I know that's not necessarily a view that will that is popular in the blindness and vision impairment field. So I respect that there are different views, but in my view, I would rather have gone to school with my neighbours and the kids who lived in my community. I used to go home of a weekend and sometimes have quite lonely weekends, because all my mates lived long drives away, and I didn't enjoy that, and I would change that. But that's not to in any way denigrate the wonderful... commitment and passion of the teachers who taught me at Northrop School. And there's no question that the school was incredibly well-resourced and that the teachers were very passionate and committed. But I would have traded that off to go to a mainstream school if I had my time over again.
So after leaving school and going to university, did you find that a much more for you inclusive environment?
Well, no, not for the first 12 months because I couldn't get a job. I experienced what many of us have experienced, and I went to about 30 job interviews. Well, firstly, I would make phone calls, and I used to tell people that I was totally blind and I didn't even get interviews. And then I worked that one out and thought, well, we'll change that approach. And so I didn't tell people on the phone. So the first time they knew was when I walked in with my white cane. But I went to about 30 job interviews in a year and didn't get any of those jobs. And for me, that was a time where the real discrimination sort of impacted on me for the first time, really. And so I came to understand that, and it was quite a tough year in my life. And finally, I decided that I had to do it a different way, have a different approach. And I did the public service exam and joined the New South Wales Public Service as a clerical assistant, which is the bottom level of the New South Wales Public Service. And my first job, in fact, was answering the telephone and telling people the winning lotto numbers. And, of course, you need a law degree to do that. But and I was made redundant from that job by an answering machine. So, then I moved to other government departments and finally persuaded the head of the legal in the Department of Consumer Affairs to give me a job first as a legal clerk and a legal officer. So, like most of us, I was significantly underemployed and I really had to struggle to work my way up.
On that point, Graeme, and you've actually stolen about my next three questions, but you said you didn't want to consult beforehand. Maybe we should have.
Yeah, no.
Obviously, having a degree and to an extent thinking at that stage in probably about early 20s,
yep,
that life would just go ahead and things would fall in place.
I did, yep.
You said that was a demoralising experience going into that clerical position and not using the skills you had. What would your advice be to anyone that finds themselves in that position? Do they hold out or do they take what comes and worry about it later?
I think as people who are blind or vision impaired, one of the things that, and I don't like this, but I think one of the things that we have to accept is that if we want to get into the into work, we have to take jobs below our skill level. And we just have to prove ourselves all the way up. And I think it's incredibly unfair, but it's also the reality. And, you trade that off about against not having a job at all. Well, you're going to be far better off both economically and socially if you're in a job. And for many of us, the problem is that, to use a favourite phrase of Bill Jolly's in our younger days, in BCA, people who you'd find them a job and then forget them. And so many people who are blind or vision impaired get stuck at that lower level. So I recognise the risk of that, but are you better to be stuck at that lower level or stuck outside the employment market? And that's the trade-off. And it's not a very good trade-off. I don't like it, but I think that's the reality.
I think the first time I met you was the first BCA convention I ever went to, which was in 1981, the Year of People with Disability, in Melbourne.
Mm.
And I think Stephen and Bill Jolly had a bit of a word to me and says, oh, you might like to come along to this. So I turned up a bit sort of wet behind the ears and thought, well, what's this all about? Sat there for the first half day and thought, gee, these people take it all pretty seriously, don't they? We had Hugh Jeffrey and Dolly Lee and Harold Gracian and a few in fine form, David Blythe. Anyway, I thought, yeah, this is pretty serious stuff. And then at lunchtime, this bloke I'd never met walked up to me and says, do you want to help me organise an election? And I thought, they do play hard, don't they? So I did establish first, does he want me to help him organise an election or count votes? And they can be two quite different things.
Ah, yes, that's right.
I know we had quite a bit of local government input today, but but so once I established that he wanted me to help him just count votes, I was quite comfortable and happy to do so. That was my introduction to Graeme Innes, I think, but it's been a lasting one. It's been wonderful. But on BCA, Graeme, you weren't in right at the start. My spies tell me you took a little bit of convincing to get involved. But once you did, you went health or ever. Have you got some thoughts on what BCA did for you and what you saw as a young person, what BCA had to offer, not just to the community, but in your own development?
Well, so the first thing I should say, Michael, is that just like the rockers of the 60, if you can remember those early conventions, you weren't really there.
Yes.
I do remember that first convention that you were at. I did take a little while to be persuaded. It was largely the Sydney-Melbourne thing, to be honest. And BCA started in Melbourne, and the first convention I attended was the Sydney convention at, I think we were at the Canterbury-Helston Park. 77 or 78? I thought it was 77, okay. I went to that one. That was the first one when David and Bill and Carmel and Stephen and Vicky and a few others came up on the train. And I remember that one pretty well because coming up on the train, someone was reading the ads in the papers, you'll recall this, Bill, about to raise money for Royal Blind Society, and it was about Tom R. burnt his fingers on the stove because he couldn't find where it was. And now with his burnt fingers, how would he read Braille because he was totally blind? It was an awful fundraising campaign, and I've seen David Blyth fired up a few times in my life, but I tell you what, he was fired up about that. RBS to the rescue, I think, was the tagline. And I remember meeting these people, Bill and Stephen and Carmel and Vicky, and I remember Carmel later told me that she met this young bloke from Sydney who was a bit of an arrogant young bloke, you know, didn't like to talk to the likes of us and thought he knew it all. That's probably a pretty good impression, Carmel. You're probably pretty right. And I met David, and one of my memories is of Maxine Hewitt at that convention, and just what an impressive woman she was. And I just remember thinking, wow, these blind people are pretty impressive and pretty articulate, some pretty talented and energetic debates and presentations over policy matters, pretty rigorous debate. And I debated at school and at university a bit, and I thought, gee, these guys are pretty good. And so I decided to get more involved. And I guess I realised what I'd known from my younger days when my dad had been a friend of David Hunter, who was a totally blind member of Parliament, had been for 30 years in the seat of Ashfield. And he was the first blind person that I met. And I always remember thinking, well, if he can be a member of Parliament, I can do anything I want. And then I met all of these people, and they were, you know, computer programmers and doing various other things. And I saw the benefit of learning from each other and of working collectively towards a goal. And that's what drew me to BCA, and that's what's kept me here.
Graham, also a comparison. I think in those days things were... I think in the modern vernacular it said that there were some fairly robust discussions.
There were. Absolutely.
It was a fairly dynamic organisation. Yeah. There were strong vocal differences of opinion that were out there in formulating policy and so forth.
Yep.
Now, if you come to a BCA convention or conference these days, some would say things are more sophisticated. Some would say they're more subtle. Some would say they're more sterile. Do you have an opinion on the comparison?
I think they're more sophisticated. And I think they're more subtle and more nuanced. I think that in those days there was a bunch of young people around my age who pushed hard, pretty hard through to lead the organisation. And we were pretty inexperienced and probably fairly brash. And we called things pretty directly. And that probably did us quite a lot of good. It might have also done us some damage, but I'm not suggesting it wasn't the right thing at the time. I think the leadership of BCA is now, by the time you come to leadership, there's a bit more experience and capacity to nuance things a little bit. And I think there were some early battles that we had to have, and we've learned... from those, there were early battles that we had to have because we had to establish a place of equality with people providing services to us, because we didn't have that back in the 70s and 80s. And really, we had to establish more than that. We had to establish a place of primacy, because it was about us, and you know, we needed to be the centre of the conversation. And the tough battles are when people in service provision agencies and governments forget that, and we have to remind them who is the reason for their paychecks, or the you know, the reason for their existence. And I think they're the tough times for BCA when you have to assert that. We had to do that a lot in the 70s and 80s and into the 90s to establish that, because there hadn't been a strong voice of people who are blind or vision impaired. There'd been a voice, but it wasn't a strong voice. So I think BCA now is an organisation for the times. So I don't think one is stronger than the other. The conferences are perhaps quieter. I think, too, that we do need to, as an organisation, work to draw in younger people again, and we have to find ways to do that, because the ways that we've had in the last 15 or 20 years haven't worked so well. Although I tell you what, in BCNSW, I reckon we've dropped the average age of the organisation by about 15 to 20 years in the last two, which is one of the reasons I took on the job as president of the organisation, because we had to, because if we didn't do that, the organisation was going to go out of existence. So it's a constant thing that we have to do, and we haven't found the right formula yet. I think we've found some of it, but we have to keep working at it.
Graeme, earlier tonight you and I were having a bit of a conversation about religion, and I'm not going to go into that discussion because I said I wouldn't, but we all know about the story of turning water into wine. You at one stage were going over to Italy to do an Italian language course, but I also know there's another motivation for going overseas. These days it may well be called stalking. But nevertheless, you took a trip, and we all, as I said, know about turning water into wine, but you had the rare ability to turn braille paper into wine, I believe.
Oh, well, or wine into braille paper and
or
then
something.
Back.
Yes.
So I was... I'd met Maureen in Perth, and it's interesting, I did an interview on Wendy Harmer's program when I launched my book, and the first comment to me on air, and she didn't warn me at all about this, and she just said, "Well, you know, I've never understood, having read your book, why your wife didn't take out an AVO against you." How do you respond to that on radio? I did pursue Maureen around the world. I decided that she was the one that I wanted to spend the rest of my life with, and despite the fact that she said no to me about 25 times, I just thought that she hadn't yet worked out, didn't quite yet know her own mind, and I just needed to convince her. I was travelling to Italy, and I had a... you might remember the suit packs. I used to carry a suit pack, and they were these bags that folded over in half, but you stood them up, you hung them up in the wardrobe. They had a hook on the top, and you could keep your suits less crushed in the bag. But I didn't have any suits in that bag. I had other clothes, and I had three or four bottles of Western Australian wine and champagne, I think some chocolates. Anyway, it weighed in at 27 k's over the limit. And I was with my dad at the airport, because he dropped me at the airport, and the woman said to me, I'm sorry, sir, the bag's overweight, we're going to have to charge you for it. And I looked at Dad with the movement of my head and eyes, which I hoped meant keep quiet, I'm going to spin a line here. And I looked at her and I said, "Oh, well, I'm a student. I can't really afford to pay the excess luggage. I suppose, Dad, I'll just have to leave all my Braille study books here in Australia." And she just hit the lever and sent the bag down the chute. So, yeah, didn't quite work in Sri Lanka. No, the Noritake.
We've still got it.
You still got the Noritake. No. No, we got a bit of Noritake through customs in Singapore.
So that,
and a few stereos, a few stand-up record players, I recall. Yeah.
So, Graham, it's, you can always trust what a lawyer says.
Yeah.
And it does remind me of the time that the devil and God were having a bit of a dispute. They lived next door to each other. And there was some sort of fencing issue, and they couldn't resolve it. And they ended up, they went to the council, no, we can't help you. They went to mediation, they went everywhere, and it was still an issue. And God gets annoyed one day and shrugs his shoulders and says to the devil, I'm going to get a lawyer. And the devil just looks at him and says, where the hell would you find a lawyer?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they're all on my side of the fence. That's right.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Graham, you were heavily involved in the merger of the four blindness agencies into Vision Australia. You were the chairman of the board, I think, of RBS at the time.
Yes, that's right.
And then you led the first board.
Yes, correct.
And obviously pushed that very hard. However many years it is up the track, what, 10, 12?
I resigned in 2005 when I was appointed as a commissioner, so it's, what, 11 years now.
Okay. Easy in retrospect. Are things where you thought they'd be 10 or 12 years up the track?
Yeah.
Wasn't a leading question?
No, it's not a leading question. It's a good question. Yeah. I know the people who are recording this, so... no, they're not where I want them to be. They're not where I'd want them to be. I was talking to someone about this in the last day or so, and I remember I was so optimistic about the work that we did around the merger of Vision Australia. I was so optimistic about a strong partnership where people who are blind and vision impaired would just move in more and more to the roles of running the organisation, and that it would become our agency as it has in the UK, in Canada, in a number of places in America, and in other countries around the world. I don't think that that's what we've achieved, I think that I'm, in retrospect, not disappointed that I was involved with the merger, because I still think the merger, I think what we need is, what we needed and what we still need is a national blindness agency. I am disappointed in where it is now and the direction that it's taken and some of the things that it's done over the last few years. And I haven't really been that frank before, so... but, yeah...
Okay, well, we might move on.
Yeah.
So back to more serious topics. Graham, I believe once you were sitting at near one of Australia's icons, the dog on the tucker box, and we all know you as a person of influence and persuasion.
Yeah.
And you took on some bikies.
Well, yeah. So we did stop at the dog on the tucker box on the way back from one of the early DPI formation meetings in Wagga. And in the car were here come some names that will bring back some memories. So there was Ian Irwin was driving, and he's a guy with genesis imperfecta. So he's a little guy. He uses a wheelchair. I don't think Ian Cooper was in the car. But he was around, but I don't think Ian Cooper was with us. Laurie Allsop was in the car. She used a walking stick at that stage. She was walking before she had to go into a wheelchair. I was there, and there was someone else. I can't think who it was, but all of us with visible disabilities. And so we went into the dog on the tucker box and to get ourselves a feed and have a bit of a break on the road back to Sydney, as you do. And there was a woman in charge at the cash register. And there was a group of bikies, you know, not the bikers who enjoy a bit of a Saturday afternoon ride and getting rid of a bit of testosterone, but they're really underneath quite nice, decent guys. These were bikies who, you know, communicated in grunts and wore chains around their necks, and they were giving this woman
Ashfield High Boys, were they?
Sorry,
Ashfield High Boys, were they?
I could have been, maybe. Yeah, don't know. But I was going to say something else, but I won't say it. They were giving this woman a pretty hard time, and you know, in a very sexist, abusive, inappropriate way.
Trump, yeah. Was the name.
They were the Trump bikies. Yeah, that's right. I don't know if any of any physical activity actually occurred, but I wasn't aware of that. But there was certainly a lot of verbal, and I just found it fairly offensive, and I thought, well, what's one guy with a white cane whose pec's going to need a lot of work going to do against five or six of these chain wielding guys? So I came up with a plan, because you know you need a strategy. I learned this in BCA and in other places. So I borrowed the car keys from Ian Irwin, and I got my white cane, and I was prominently showing it as I walked out to the car, tapped my way out to the car, got in the car. The bikes were parked all around the car because they'd pulled up after us. So I got in the car, revved up the engine twice. Well, I've never seen more bitumen burned. They had more love for their machines than for what they were doing, that's for sure, because I've never seen a group leave a place quicker. So at least that's how I tell the story to my kids in the car. So, you know.
Graham, I'd just like to go back to the introduction and your work as Disability Discrimination Commissioner. One thing I'd just like to get your thoughts on, which you said you had three visits to detention centres.
Mm.
Are you able to sort of elaborate and tell us a little bit about that and what that left you feeling and thinking?
It was the toughest thing I did when I was a commissioner, because I saw people who were denuded of optimism and often devoid of hope. They were locked away in a place that, from where there was no understanding of when they would leave. So there was no time on when they would leave. So in that sense, it was worse than a jail sentence, because at least you know when your jail sentence is going to end. You have a date. These people had no date. They had no hope. And all they had done, they hadn't committed any crimes. All they had done was made what I think must be one of the most difficult decisions in the world, to leave the country where they were raised and brought up and to move to another place across the sea. And many of them, most of them had come by boat. Some of them, their boats didn't actually quite make it to here, and so they were rescued and brought to Australia, and then just locked away in these places. And I saw people with mental health issues, psychosocial disabilities as a result of being in detention. I saw people, as I say, devoid of hope. I saw little kids who had spent their whole lives locked behind wire. I'm probably telling a lot of stories which my friend Amir, who is here tonight, could relate to. And Amir experienced that journey as a person who's totally blind. And, you know, we think we have tough things to deal with here in Australia. And that, for me, puts it right in perspective. And I found it very difficult, because I couldn't do much to change the government policy. And in my book, I actually wrote about the fact that it was... I've always been able to find a way to see a direction for the future on an issue, but I can't see one on this issue. And it saddens me and makes me feel ashamed as an Australian that we are doing that to people, and all they have sought from us is rescue from the situation that we're in. And I can't understand it. If someone's house was burning down next door and they jumped out the window rather than going through the door and came to us as their neighbours, we would welcome them in with open arms. And Australians have done that over and over again. And that's what asylum seekers do, and we lock them up with no promise of any future. And it's one of the things that most saddens me. Can I...
The American solution,
I don't really know enough about it, Bill, to comment on it. I know something's been announced today where our asylum seekers on... The concept has been announced where our asylum seekers in Manus and Nauru will go to the US. And this is a deal that they're trying to rush through before while Obama is still president. Very understandable. And we will take some asylum seekers from South America. Well, look, if it gets people off Manus and Nauru, then it's got to be a better option. I don't know what I think about, you know, people who, you know, taking people in that different direction, but it's got to be better than Manus or Nauru. So in that sense, I'd be supportive, but I can't say much more about it until we see some more details, because I don't know what other deal's been done. But can I tell you one story about... detention centres. I was inspecting detention centres, and one of the managers of the detention centre said, "Oh, it's really good that that we've got you here, because he said, you know, when we built this centre, we were of course required to make it meet the accessible building standards, and so you know they had ramps and accessible toilets, and they said, and we had these signs put on the doors of the toilets." In Braille, and we're a bit worried because we're not sure what they say. And so I read the Braille, and in one centre they had the women's on the men's toilet and the men's on the women, and the accessible toilet said fire escape. So...
we are about to wind up in a minute. Just a couple of final questions, if I may, Graham. Firstly, there were 40 or 50,000 words that didn't make it.
Yeah.
Noting we do have two or three lawyers at least in the room, are you able to elaborate on any of that stuff?
Oh, it's a tricky question, because so I wrote the stuff and someone mentioned a story, or I mentioned a story which I thought was in the book, and a person who... had read the book, didn't remember it. So I'm a bit worried now as to whether it was one of the ones that was cut. One of the things that I did at the beginning of every chapter was took a couple of lines from a song that I really thought spoke about or spoke to that chapter. And there was actually quite a lot of songs from Leonard Cohen, who's just passed away yesterday. And they all went for two reasons. One, because we had to cut down words, and also the publisher said, well, we're going to have to pay copyright on all of these lines if you put them in, so we don't know that that's such a good idea. You know, there was a lot of the more detailed policy issues around the work that I did at the Human Rights Commission. It wasn't taken out, but it was compressed. But the interesting story that was suggested to me isn't in the book, but I thought it was one about... The man who spoke to us this morning, who's the chair of the Victorian Transport Advisory Committee, and I were in Perth, and we're at a party. He went over with me to Perth when I moved to Perth, and I think the year before for a holiday. And we were at a party where there was a attractive female iridologist who was looking into the eyes of Chris and telling him... It was in the book, was it?
No, it's not.
It's not?
No, not.
Oh. Oh, okay. Well, it did go. Okay. Well, anyway, I'll tell the story. So this woman was looking deeply into Christopher's eyes and telling him, you know, about what his life was going to be like. And Chris was unattached at this stage and, you know, as Chris did, enjoying very much the female attention. And this conversation went on for 15 or 20 minutes, and finally I just had enough of it, really. And I said to her, well, okay, you know, that's got Chris sorted out for the next 30 or 40 years, so what do you reckon about me? And she held the torch up to my eyes, because it was getting a bit dark by that stage. We were out in the garden at this party. And she's looking into my eyes, and she said, "Oh, it's very dark." She said, I can't really see too deeply into your eyes to tell you, you know, what's going to happen to you. And slightly beer-fueled, I whipped out one of my prostheses and said, here you go, have a closer look.
Thanks, Graeme.
That's now, a good story for a BCA convention. But the best result of all that was that she almost fainted. And guess whose arms were just there to catch her as she fell? And they weren't mine.
We're just about to finish. I believe Stephen Jolly has one very quick question, but we need a mic there if we can get it. And then we'll be wrapping up in a sec. Desserts on the way around if you haven't got it already.
Stephen.
And please start eating. Don't. Yes. I'm totally relaxed about that.
Yeah. So. Thanks, Michael, and thanks, Graeme, for your interesting presentation. Graeme, I note that your exercise over the last few months has been really resulted in quite a community exercise around the country, speaking with many people who have to live with normal sight and have little contact with blindness or low vision.
I feel for them, Stephen.
Now, some of these people, though, are very, very perceptive. And I was at one of your presentations recently at the Wheeler Centre in Melbourne, and I'm reminded of that. And I need to ask the question, which was a very incisive question that came from one of the audience, and we haven't touched on it tonight. It's not about the elephant in the room. About the dog, the beautiful doggie of yours, how do you know when she wants to go to the toilet? And how do you look after her then?
I'd forgotten that question was asked. I don't think I need to answer the actual question here tonight, but I'm glad you reminded us and told us that. And look, there's no doubt. I mean, there's a couple of chapters at least of dog stories in my book for those who haven't read it. And my favourite again relates to our friend Christopher, who's not here, and his wife. I won't spoil the story now, but his wife Trish, who I think has just about forgiven me, but it took many years. No, it didn't take long at all. She was very generous about it. But if you don't know that story, then you haven't bought the book, have you? So. I'll leave that one to. It is in BCA News, yeah. But you've got to be a student.
And it's really
of the
a Christmas
archives.
Story, Graeme.
But can I tell one other story before we finish that wasn't published in the book? And it's about our trip to Sri Lanka, and a number of us who are here, Stephen and Vicky, Bill and Carmel, Michael, myself. Not sure if there's anyone else from that trip. Yeah, I think that's about it. But there's about 18 of us who went to Sri Lanka. I won't tell you the story about my first game in Sri Lanka because, again,
no,
that's
in the
book. But this one isn't. And Michael and I have always joked with each other about our height difference because Michael's, what, 4'11"?
I got the stepladder out tonight.
Yeah, to get up onto the stool. And I'm
5'4", by the way.
5'4", yeah. Oh, okay. And so Michael always used to joke with me that his guiding services only went to 5'4". And after that, I had to make my own arrangements. And that was proved to be the case when we were walking along this road in Sri Lanka. And as in a lot of Asian countries, there are numerous stalls selling food and various other bits and pieces along the roadside. And they often, or this one, particular one, used a rope line tied to the stall and then across to the wall to keep it up. And the footpath went between the stall and the wall. Well, Michael walked straight under the rope. I didn't. Caught me about throat level, I reckon. Didn't quite hang me, but the rope snapped and the whole stall collapsed. And I'm not sure if this bit's true, so Michael might want to deny it, but I said to him, oh, geez, Michael, should we stop and help? And he just said, no, keep walking.
All I would add is that the rope should have been tied slightly better to the tent, and I should have been walking slightly quicker.
That's right.
Anyway, that brings it to an end. I've got one very quick last question for Graeme, then I want to pass over to John for a minute. Great. Have you got the lotto numbers? It's Saturday night.
The lotto numbers? No, you've got to call up the answering machine.
Fair enough. Look, I would really like to thank Graham for making the time to come and talk to us tonight. Having read the book, it is a really interesting book to read. Part of that's because we know Graham and we understand a lot of the experiences he's talked about. But I found a lot of stuff I didn't know about. It's a very insightful book. It's a great read. And Graham, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Michael. And it's available on... It's available on audible.com now, so the audio version is out, and I narrated it myself. It's not like me, but I omitted to mention that. But
a section.
But can I say that it wasn't a task at all to come and talk to a group of people who are blind or vision impaired. I feel completely at home at these functions and amongst my broader family, and it was a pleasure to share some of my experiences with you. It was a challenging task to read the audio, yeah. It was much harder work than I thought it would be. Okay, that's another story.
It's John here, and I've asked for the microphone to intervene here to do two things. Firstly, I think that it should go down in the annals of BCA that Michael Janes, you have at least reached parity with Graham. When you're on that stool, you're the same height. But more particularly...
It wasn't in vain that I came tonight, John.
That's right. More particularly, I think as well as thanking Graham for his contribution, we do need to thank Michael Delroy Janes for his excellent interviewing. Yeah. A job well done, Michael.
Yeah, thank you.